We're weeks away from 2020, and I'm proud to announce that cannabis legalization has taken yet another step forward. Last month, the House Judiciary Committee passed a bill designed to legalize cannabis nationwide. And when that happens, my friends, America is going to look a whole lot different. If there's one thing I learned about watching that Prohibition documentary series on Netflix, it's the magical power of being at the right industry at the right time. When the asteroid of legal cannabis drops on America, the existing cannabis brands, activists, influencers, and thought leaders will become the new icons of Generation Cannabis. I am a strong advocate for cannabis legalization, not just for personal reasons, but also because we've locked up too many fucking people, predominantly black and brown folks, all for a plant that white cannabis brands are making a fortune off of. But before we can take those extra steps forward into the light of nationwide legalization, we need to have more conversations about cannabis. We need to normalize it and show that it's a diverse plant that improves the lives of many people. This is how I feel, and also how my good friend Cortez feels. Cortez Sutton is the owner of High & Mighty, a cannabis brand and apparel company. I invited him onto the podcast for a discussion on cannabis culture, cannabis gear, mental health, and criminal justice. So kick back, grab a drink, and tune in to another installment of Lag Radio.
Hey, what's up, man?
Nice to meet you. Oh my gosh, look at you, have like the whole background and everything.
Yeah, what's going on, man? Let me just
I'm doing pretty well. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, thanks for having me on.
Of course. Really is happy. Is that your office over there?
This is my home, yeah, and it is my office. I got a couple of things I'll show you guys later. I'm gonna keep it a little sneak peek for them.
Awesome. Well, yeah. just to let you know, I mean, the shirt fits perfectly. It looks amazing. I can't wait to go ahead and wear it outside.
I appreciate it, man. I appreciate your support. I was really excited to just connect with you. I've been on your page since the beginning when you first started building up. It's funny, I just got my top fan badge like 2 days ago.
Oh my god, hey, perfect timing, right?
yeah, but I'm excited, man. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, Cortez, I'd like to give you a chance to introduce yourself. Tell me a little bit about your business. What is High & Mighty and how did it start?
Absolutely. So High & Mighty is a brand that I designed with the idea that as we move forward with the legalization of cannabis, I think that we're going to get to a point where people are going to be comfortable wearing, you know, their lifestyle and their culture on them. You know, there's a lot of places where cannabis is still criminalized, and a lot of people that indulge in the industry, you know, they're quiet about it. So I had this idea that one day, you know, it would get to the point where everyone would be comfortable wearing cannabis. And then I was like, wait a minute, there's nothing out there that's really fly, that really fresh and clean that, you know, you would wear. I sat down and started doing it. And here we are, you know.
Awesome. For you, you know, talking about the legalization of cannabis, why, I'm sure you have a number of interests. Why design a brand around cannabis? What exactly does cannabis mean to you in your life? How has it had an impact on you?
That's a great question. Thanks for asking that. I currently live in Brooklyn, New York, but I was born in a small island called St. Vincent and the Grenadines. We're a small Caribbean island. We have some of the best cannabis in the world. And to me, cannabis is a plant that I've been using since I've been younger. My family uses it. When I was growing up, my family used to make tea out of it. right?
Wow.
Yeah, they would boil it and make tea out of it. The hemp, they use the hemp as well. I started using it like most kids in the inner city, for recreational purposes. But as I began to study it more and more information came out about it, you see the other health benefits of it. I currently have a grandmother that lives overseas in the West Indies, and she's just a staunch opponent to all types of drugs, right? She's a retired nurse, and she's a staunch opponent to all types of drugs. I have her now taking CBD oil.
Wow. it's funny because
Yeah.
the last guest that I had last week that I spoke with in private, he was actually talking about how he had his father who was, I believe, going through chemotherapy, and he was on like how many different prescription drugs, and then he switched them onto CBD, and it significantly helped him out. And it's interesting to see so many people like start off with CBD and starting to like look into cannabis and really the culture, which is kind of funny because like to talk about cannabis culture like in the 80s in America, it would be completely different than what it is now. So like based off of how you've seen cannabis evolve, and since you said that it's sort of been a part of your life for a long time, how have you seen it change? How have you seen it like destigmatize? And like, what are your sort of thoughts on that?
Yeah, we're around the corner from where I work. About a month ago, downtown Brooklyn, they opened up a dispensary. Right? New York City has a medical marijuana program. A lot of people are not aware of it, but they do have a program. So they have a dispensary there. About 4 or 5 blocks away is the Brooklyn Detention Center. Right,
Wow.
where there are people incarcerated for marijuana. So it's like you got a jail down the block, people are incarcerated for marijuana, and then a few blocks away there's this beautiful state of the art. It looks like it's from the Jetsons, this dispensary, So that right there is like the epitome of the industry right now. In other states in America, you have people literally under the jail for selling, consuming, possession marijuana. And then in other parts of the country, we have places like Colorado where the state government is running out of marijuana. So that's definitely something that I want to address as well. The line is about the fashion, but I also definitely going to have some activism behind it.
Yeah, it's weird. You're talking about that dichotomy and that split between like on one side of the street, you could have a dispensary that is state of the art and has the latest in cannabis technology, and then you also have these detention centers, and it really speaks to, how in the United States, like you have states where it's completely legal and you can walk around stoned out of your mind and be completely fine, and then you have, you walk across a line and then you would get thrown in jail.
Yeah.
How would you see the pathway towards cannabis legalization? Because for me, like I live in Texas, unfortunately,
Yeah.
and I came from California, so it's like, the cannabis culture is just totally different. Like, do you see, like, how do you sort of foresee this playing out? Do you think that it's just a matter of like, okay, this state needs to legalize it first, or do you think that there are certain activists who are leading the charge? Like, how do you see this playing out?
I think with all things with these type of racial dynamics in America, I think it's going to be a fight, right? It's going to be a fight. When I think about cannabis legalization, I think about income inequality, right? And as long as America's been America, there's always been that fight to keep this imbalance, right? So like right here in New York, there's like hold up. My understanding of it is that there's some hold up right now because New York is a big farm state, You know, upstate New York, a lot of apples are grown. And from my understanding, that demographic, the farmers, they want to control the legalization here in New York, you know, because everyone knows it's a cat. Everyone knows it's a cash cow. We see what's happening in other states and other countries, and you know, they're going to set it up where they keep, you know, black and brown folk out. What we have to do is we have to get on a policy initiative. You know, we have to get on a policy initiative so that, you know, we can get ground in there as well. Real quick, I just wanted to say, I think what they're trying to do here in New York is they're trying to say that if marijuana becomes legal, you have to had been in the farming industry in order to now get in it. Yeah, and then they
Oh, so
also,
you have to have like that history. You can't just like go in there straight.
you can't be a new, no new farmers.
Wow.
No new farmers, yeah, so
And it almost sort of like reinforces essentially the pre-existing system, because a lot of farmers t that tend to be supported by the government tend to be white owned. And so it still continues that history of like, or the ongoing discussion of how, you know, there is this huge cash cow of, okay, you know, legalizing cannabis, and it's a huge business. I mean, you have dispensaries, like individual dispensaries making like $1 million a month. So there's so much money to be made. And especially when you talk about cannabis and CBD as an alternative for a lot of different prescription drugs, and just like using it as a method to you know, provide for your family because it's a source of income. Like there's just so much going on, and you can almost sense like the government sort of waiting, like, oh shit, like how can we make money off of this? How can we strategize this to like make sure that our people get a chunk of this pie first? Like it's really weird seeing this. Like you can totally see the corporatization of cannabis.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, with that comes the money. You know, that comes the money comes with that, influence, the policy comes with that influence. So what we have to do is we have to not be reactive. Right, a lot of times we're reactive on social issues, and there's a few organizations here in New York. One of them is Women of Color in Cannabis, that I attend. They do a lot of different seminars and things like that. Because right now, I think something that's really huge is just the information. A lot of people are not aware of like the basics, you know, with the policy changes and where it's legal, where it's not, CBD, THC. So I think one thing that's really important is that we have to start just informing people on what's going on, right? And then that way we could be proactive with some policy initiatives, you know, because if we don't, you know, the same thing is going to happen that happens with all the other industries that went from illegal to legal.
So from a policy perspective, like what do you think needs to be put into place to make sure that this all smoothed out, like from a policy level? Because I guess I'm not too familiar about the granular, like, okay, like policy based off of like certain states. Can you tell us a little bit more about like what the movement is like, what types of policies we should be keeping an eye out for?
Definitely people that are currently incarcerated for marijuana in states where it's legal, we should fight for retroactivity. Right? We
Like,
should fight for
t expunging records and.
definitely expunging records, but also if you're incarcerated for marijuana and then it becomes legal, we can't say, well, okay, from this date we legalized it, moving forward. You know, you got to make amends for the people that are currently incarcerated, right?
Yeah, because for all the years that they had essentially been in jail for a substance that we've now legalized and now commercialized.
Absolutely,
So
absolutely.
how
You know,
does that like how do you structure that? You know, like how are there like what are the ongoing conversations? Like, oh, if you know, were incarcerated for 5 years, like how do they calculate how much that is worth?
well, as far as people receiving money, for time that they've been away, I don't see that happening. Right? I don't see that happening. Yeah. I mean, there people may push for that agenda. I was more in the line of, if you're incarcerated and then they legalize it, you should be released immediately.
Correct.
All right?
Correct.
You should be released immediately. Yeah, as far as people receiving money for that, I don't know. You know, I don't know how that would work out, but I definitely believe people should be released if they they're incarcerated under certain laws. And then, you know, we want to fight for policy initiatives where the guidelines or the process of getting in the industry, we're not locked out because of finances or because of policies on you having to be a farmer prior or things like that. You know, we got to fight for policy that makes a level playing field.
Yeah, and there is a comment by Finau that says, hi, everyone. Wow, that's crazy. And most established farmers are white. New York knows what they are pushing with that. Yeah, it's interesting that they have that that stipulation about, like, you have to have previously been a farmer, because most people know that, like, you can have a sizable cannabis, you know, farm, like, in a room. And so for them to, like, establish,
you want
to
see one? I'm just kidding.
Yeah, and it's weird, because it's almost like, I'm wondering if their logic was, oh, well, you know, most people who are going to have the farms are going to have the real estate for that land, and to have that real estate, you know, most of the time it's going to be folks who are white.
Yeah,
it's just, it's pretty wild. So for you, let's go back in a little bit to your business. You started designing this brand. Like, how many years have you been at it? And what would you say is, like, the hardest thing about growing and scaling this business?
Yeah. Well, I started the concept of High and Mighty 2 years ago. I did all my paperwork with the government. I registered everything, but I had a couple of things going on. I was in school full time, working full time. I'm a dad, so I couldn't really put the energy that I wanted towards it, so I shelved it. We officially relaunched on 420 of this year, right? So we're babies, we're babies. But something that is so inspiring is on social media, offline, in the streets, stores or whatever, everyone that sees our product and sees the logos and everything, they all respond the exact same way. You know, everyone is super excited and they just love the brand and the concept. So, you know, that pushes us. Anyone out there that starts a new business, especially clothing, they know how difficult it can be. Scaling is something that's very important with a business, because you don't want to scale too fast. You don't want to have too much merchandise. So what we're doing is we're growing. We're just growing it organically. You know, we're growing it organically. I have the website up, highandmighty.com. You can find all of our products on there. We have social media, Facebook, Instagram. And then here in New York, we have, I don't know if you have these in Texas, but here in New York, we have smoke shops. You know, we have smoke shops. You have the smoke shops. Yeah. So, you know, one day I was like, wow, these smoke shops, these are where my clients, these are where my customers are going. So I started speaking to a few of the owners here in Brooklyn, and they saw our stuff and they're like, yeah, bring it. Let's go. So we're in some.
So you're sold in a couple of those smoke shops. Awesome.
Yeah. We're in some smoke shops.
Well, congratulations.
And, thank you so much, man. Thank you. Yeah. And, you know, people like you, that, you know, I reach out. I remember you had to post up about the new restaurant. Yeah. So I just reach out to everyone and, you know, just let them see what we have, and just growing it organically like that. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about cannabis from a more personal perspective, because for me, one of the things that I've talked about is how, you know, when I discovered cannabis was an eye-opening experience because I always felt like my mind has always been really busy. You know, it's hard for me to turn off all the different like electricity that's going on in my brain. And you know, for the first time in my life, like trying cannabis allowed me to sort of like silence things and allowed me to tune in. You know, like if I'm playing Super Smash Brothers, like I'm zoned in. If I'm writing something, I'm zoned in. And it's funny because it reminds me of my brother. My brother, he grew up smoking cannabis a lot growing up, and this is before I was into it. And I was like, "Ooh, that's bad for you." And he would say, like, you know, he would swear by it. And I think it's just interesting that everyone has sort of different reactions to it, and they use cannabis in different ways to do different things. For you personally, how has cannabis been used to shape and enhance your life? Like, do you use it to do certain things, or if, when you're feeling a certain way, like how do, like where does it factor into your life?
Yeah, for me, cannabis is it. For me, it opens up my creativity. You know, I studied sociology in school, and I always joke around with my friends because, you know, my professors would always write me like personal emails. I had one professor wrote me a personal email just thanking me for the material that I brought to class. You know, and my explanation for it is cannabis, right? I would indulge in cannabis before writing my papers, while doing my research, while creating my clothing, and it for me it just opens up my creativity. Something like you, like my mind is always going at a thousand. I'm always thinking about a million things at one time, and when I use cannabis, it really helps me to like just focus, and the ideas that I come up with are just. They're really good sometimes. Sometimes they're a little crazy, but mostly.
I know what you mean. Sometimes it's like, sometimes you like you have to know that limit where like there's the sweet spot where it's like, okay, I'm getting good ideas, and then other times where it's like, whoa, the ideas are too good. Like I need to reel them in a little bit more.
You're like, let me table this right here.
So,
Definitely.
for you, you know, one of the another topics within cannabis that I think is really interesting, because it tends to be very personalized, is, you know, how do you prefer to consume your cannabis? I know that some people swear by edibles, some people swear by wax. For me, I am like, if I'm in, you know, in my own element, I prefer like a glass bong. I prefer to be like iced, so it's nice and cool. And you kind of just like, you know, let it hang out there. How about you? What is your method? I know that you've tagged a couple of your posts with cannabis gear. Like, what is your gear like? What is your setup like?
My thing is flowers. You know, I'm big on flowers. Here in New York City, we have these events, right, with a lot of different vendors. So they're bringing a lot of products. You know, a lot of those products from out of state. We're starting to see them now. And I'm still mainly the flowers, but there is this one girl. I'm sorry I don't have her name because I would have loved to mention her, but she makes these little miniature sweet potato pies. And they're infused. I'm gonna see if I could get her name and put it in the comments, right?
Awesome. Yeah, definitely.
Because yeah, these things are amazing. When I tell you they're amazing, she makes
Strong.
that. Oh my God. And it's like when you taste it, there's like a light, you know, it has a light flavor of the cannabis in it, but you feel like you're at Thanksgiving at somebody's house.
Yeah, that's the thing. So I think edibles are probably one of my favorite ways to take cannabis because, like, you it's funny because especially if it's a good edible, because some edibles like it tastes really danky, you know, and you're just like, it's a little too funky.
A little too
But
potent.
when you have like a really good recipe, and especially like a really good edible, where it's almost like you're just on this really slow roller coaster, and you just feel it like creeping up in your head, and you're like, whoa, okay, here we go, like here we go, and it's just like this weird ceiling where it just keeps going. But yeah, for me, I would say flower in a glass or edibles for me.
Flower. Yeah. And myself too, I mentioned earlier about informing people, I'm on a learning curve as well. I'm learning a lot of different things. I went to a seminar a couple of weeks ago in the city, and there were some people there. They were talking about cannabis more from the medical aspect of it. And one of the guys mentioned how in the morning he does CBD and cannabis, like that's how he starts his day off. And then throughout the day he does THC, and then later on in the day he does CBD and THC again. So, I'm learning as well. And I'm happy to try all the different combinations that there are out there.
Yeah, and that's the thing, like I always tell people, like you really have to actually like experiment with it because everybody is different. Like my wife is different, and like we could smoke the same exact thing, and I'm really chatty and I want to talk, and then she's very like quiet and reserved, and like sometimes it's just based off of different strains and whatnot. So yeah, it's like it is a learning process, and I think a lot of people, it's funny how you sometimes you'll meet these people who have tried cannabis and they're like, oh well, I tried it once and it was not for me, but it's like you have to get into it. So this is sort of leads into my next question. So one, can you remember the first time you tried cannabis? And two, can you remember the first time you tried it and you were like, whoa, okay, there's something in here? Because for me, that's how it was like. The first time I tried cannabis, I had kind of an experience where like I was driving and I was like, ooh, it feels kind of spacey. But I tried it like 3 months later, and I smoked something, and then I was watching like on my phone, and I had my phone up, and I was laying down, and then I was so baked that I thought my screen was like a wide, like a big screen TV. And so I was just tripping out, but I was like, oh my God, like what is going on here? So for you, like, can you remember a time where you were like, okay, this is like, there's something to this. This, like, I like the way that this feels. And then can you remember the very first time that you had that experience or if they were the same?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. It reminds me of something really funny when I was younger. So like I told you before, my family, is into cannabis, but when I was younger, I had an idea. I'm talking like elementary school. I had an idea that my mom was using cannabis, right? And one day I found her rolling papers, right? And I told her, I was like, hey, these rolling papers are for marijuana. She's like, no, those are not for marijuana. Those are for my hair rollers. Right. And then growing up, I remember when I was in junior high school, my friends and I, we would cut school and we would roll anything we could find. Tea bags, oregano. I know somebody on the line has to have done this when they were younger, right?
Oh yeah.
My first time using cannabis was I was about 14 years old, here in the city, and I remember just hanging out in a park with some friends and just realizing how amazing it was. I remember at first it was like this anxiety creeping up, right? That's the way I felt it. I felt like this, like, oh my God, what's gonna happen? But then it just turned into a calm. And I've always been into music. I remember listening to music, and I remember hearing stuff in the music that I had never
Yeah.
heard of
Oh,
before.
yeah. 100%. Like you listen to a song that you've heard maybe 50 times and you're like, "Whoa, dude, that vocal backing, that was not there before." And it's weird, like you can hear and I keep telling people listening to music and being stoned, like you feel the music more and it really gets you more. But sorry, keep going.
Yeah, no, so I just remember that. And then I remember another great experience I had. I went to college in Savannah, Georgia, and my school sat on a marsh. They had a marine biology program, and one day some friends of mine, we were smoking marijuana, and we decided that we were going to take the boat that they had, that the school used to collect specimens. Yeah, this is one of those crazy marijuana stories. And we all jumped into this boat. It was a push start button boat, and we're out in the marsh. We're about 15 minutes away from the school, and then the boat cuts off.
Oh,
Yeah,
shit.
the bolt cut off while we were out there. We had to get the school had to get the authorities and everything to come and get us.
Damn.
We didn't get in too much trouble though. We didn't get into too much trouble.
Damn,
Oh
well,
yeah.
you lucked out with that one.
Definitely.
So earlier, when I had messaged you, you told me that your 9 to 5, you're actually working within prison reform. We didn't get a
Yes.
chance to really expand on that. Can you tell me a little bit about what you do, and sort of why you're into this work?
Sure, absolutely. In my current position, I run transitional service programs in New York State prisons. What we basically do is we go into the prisons before guys come home and we acclimate them to the process of what reentry is like. We have a lot of classes and courses. We try to just do anything to engage the guys in there. A few weeks ago, I had a formerly incarcerated comedian come in and perform for the guys. But the main thing is about giving the guys the information that they need to come out and be successful, right? Because we know that in our military, when our personnel, once they're released, they get support from our government with reintegrating back to society because they suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. People that are incarcerated have the same rates of PTSD as military personnel. But what we do with our incarcerated is we just let them out and the support is there. There's programs, but they need to be improved. All right. So what we do is we inform guys about post-traumatic stress, how it shows up in their life. We talk about what incarceration does. We talk about the ripple effect of incarceration. What effect does it have on your family? What effect does it have on yourself? How can you come out here when you don't have a lot of resources, when you don't have a lot of support, and you just feel like, I'm not gonna leave this lifestyle that I was living in and go now at this age and try to do stuff different, but we really just a lot of information. And then when the guys get out, we also support them with connections to housing, connections to work, just anything, any level of support that they would need once they're released, we help them out. For me, the work is it's so fulfilling. It's so fulfilling to see an individual that just did 25 years and you see him get out and you see the step back and you see him putting his life back together and he calls you and it's like, hey, I bought my first car today, or I got my own apartment today. It's really it's profound, the how you can see an individual inside of a correctional institution. And then see him 2 days later outside and just physically see the shock and to see the trauma that is affecting this person that's released. And it's just about supporting. A lot of people have this idea that, we should just keep doing what we're doing with incarceration. People don't want to be locked up, they shouldn't do the crime, right? But what I always tell people is that I didn't say it. Our federal government says that no race in America, in proportion to their population, greatly exceeds another race in committing crime. All right? This is what the federal government reports every single year. But when you go into our correctional facilities, you don't see that. All right? You see black and brown people. So what I tell people is, one, the reason why we need to make some changes in prison is because it's racist. And two, at the rate that we're incarcerating in America, you may feel that it's not going to affect your life. It definitely will touch you in some shape, fashion, or form.
It's interesting that you bring up about the issue of people who've been incarcerated and then they get out, but because they don't have a mechanism to help them have a soft landing, it's like you're almost essentially just throwing out a lot of these people out in the street where they might not have family, or they might have family who doesn't want to be a part of their life anymore because of their history. What would you say is are some of the major issues or the major reasons why some people might go back and like that or what would you say are some of the biggest challenges in terms of getting them to successfully reacclimate into society and not to, you know, go back to being incarcerated?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the ways that I break it down for the men in there is we talk about change, right? As human beings, we like comfort, right? But something that most people in prison could relate to is working out, right? Guys work out in prison sometimes 2 times a day, right? When you start working out, that pain that you feel, that pain runs some people away from the gym, right? But for those of us that want to look a certain way or want to feel a certain way or lose weight or whatever, we will go back consistently and face that pain, right? Because we know that outside, on the other side of that pain, comes the results, right? So I break it down to guys that are transitioning the same way. You're going to get some pain, you're going to get some struggle. You can't run from it. You got to run towards it. You got to keep striving. And then on the other side of that, you're going to receive, what it is that you're looking for, right? Now that's the ideal, right? And a lot of people give information to people, excuse me, a lot of people give information to people, but what they don't do is tell people how, right? Like, you can inspire me, yes, you got to go, but tell me how, right?
Like, what are the actual
And
steps?
exactly. And the first thing that I let guys know is that the great thing is that you're coming out and we're living in the information age, right? So you have access to the same information as everyone else out here, right? For all intents and purposes. Now, what you have to do is you have to become a hog, right? You have to become an information hog, right? And you have to inform yourself. Anything that you're involved with, the more informed you are about that topic, the better off you're going to be. All right? That's the first part. The second part is you have to be consistent. All right? You just have to be consistent. A lot of times we start things and then we give up. Right? We give up. In my experience, what I've seen is that guys that come out and they try to make a transition in their lives, they'll try it for a little while, but then they give up. All right? And you have to be consistent. All right? You have to be consistent. I know it varies state by state, but here in New York, every day, my organization, as well as lots of others, we're in Albany with the state government, we're in the city government, and we're fighting for money, right? We're fighting for money to support people. I was involved in that federal law that passed a few years back that removed the question from the job application. Have you been convicted of a felony? Yeah, that movement started off. It was known as Ban the Box, right? So now across the country, they're not allowed to put on a job application, have you been convicted of a felony? Right? And what that does is, yeah, that opens the door for you at least to get to make that connection with somebody, right? You might be formally incarcerated, but if you could sit down in front of somebody, they'll say, hey man, like, you seem like you can do this job and we're gonna give you a shot. All right. So we share that information with guys, and then we actually connect guys to employment, right? You have a lot of guys coming out of prison that are very skilled, right? Because they're inside working for the prison industrial complex, right? So they come out with a lot of skills, but then it's like, okay, you were a fireman inside, you did customer service for the government accounting office, but now that you're out here, we can't use you. So those guys that do come out, we send them on job interviews. If they're not ready to go on a job interview, we will put them in classes to get them the certifications that they need, to get the licenses that they need to get employed.
Wow, that's incredible. I mean, so can you contrast like what types of work for the people who aren't sure, what types of work do some of these people do when they're incarcerated? And what would you say, like, when they actually are out, what types of work do they actually end up in? What have you seen the different pathways towards, like, regaining entry and sort of landing back on their feet? What types of work do they end up doing?
That's a great question. Currently inside of correctional facilities, they're doing everything from packaging spinach and potatoes and tomatoes to soldering the vehicle panels on a lot of our military vehicles, right? They're making lockers. They're making a lot of the furniture that you see inside of courtrooms are made by incarcerated people. The vests, the bulletproof vests that a lot of police officers wear are made by people that are incarcerated. So, they're doing everything inside of there. They're doing something called optical character recognition, right? Which is cleaning up digital file, cleaning up analog files into digital files, right? They're doing this type. Yeah, they're doing this type of work, customer service. But then when the guys get out, you know, because of social barriers that come with felonies, there's certain jobs that you can't get. But I've seen guys go into all manner of work. A lot of guys, when they're coming out of prison, they want to get into construction, right? Because that's a pretty open field. But I tell guys, listen, if you want to go into construction, that's fine, right? But understand that when you're thinking about work while you're in prison, and you're thinking like, okay, I'm limited. So when you actually get out and you realize that, yes, there are some limits, there's some jobs with weapons that you can't get, certain government jobs you can't get. But for the most part, you're pretty much open to a lot of different positions. So definitely be open to that. Also, be open to furthering your education. Right. Be open to furthering your education. The sad thing that I witness inside of the prisons is meeting with a lot of the younger guys still in their 20s. And when you question them about going back to school, they're like, nah, you know, that school, it's not for me. You know, I'm done. But I always let them know that, you know, when I talk about school, it's not just college. Like, everybody's not college. Right. You have people that are out here that went to non-traditional school. They're making tons of money. Right.
Yeah, like trade schools or
exactly. Mm-hmm. So we push guys in that direction. And then to answer your question, the type of positions that we've seen guys get, I mean, everything, cooks, chefs. I know one guy that got certified and he actually is working in IT.
Wow.
Yeah, he's working in IT. Just recently, I've been letting a lot of guys know Google has had such a difficult time finding qualified IT support personnel that they've actually created this program with a lot of academic institutions where they're given scholarships and they do a 6-month online course. And once you finish the course, you're a Google certified IT support specialist.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's pretty crazy.
Sorry about that.
Oh yeah, no problem. That's really cool when you were talking about earlier about you offering, you're working with this company that offers these certifications that allows people who have this experience working in these institutions, making things that are incredibly robust, whether you're talking about vests and furniture for courtrooms and whatnot. How bad would you say is the, I know this is relatively obvious, but can you give me sort of a more scientific look on what the discrimination is like for people who have been previously incarcerated, even though you said that there was that policy that banned the box. What are some of the barriers that prevent people who have been previously incarcerated from finding work? What are some of the challenges that they face in terms of trying to, land back on their feet?
Trying to get back. Yeah, well, something that I've seen that definitely needs to be worked on is you'll have guys come out. A lot of guys that come out, they're mandated by their parole or their supervised release conditions to do programs, right? A lot of guys have to do substance use programs. Guys have to do anger management, domestic violence. And granted, these programs are needed, but they need to be reviewed and not used in this broad brush type of way that they are used. For example, you have an individual that was in prison for 15 years. While he was incarcerated, there's no record of any substance use. When he was incarcerated, a lot of people, when they're arrested, they say that they were using drugs to receive a lighter sentence, right? Or to receive some type of remedy. That will come back to haunt them in the end, because you reported that drug use. 15, 20 years may have passed. When you're released from prison, you may be mandated to go to a drug program 3 days a week, 4 or 5 hours a day I've seen guys a year and a half in a drug program. All right.
Wow.
So it's like, yeah. So now you're time constraint when looking for work. All right.
Yeah.
So,
oh, good.
Yeah. Yeah. So we see that, right. That's just with the drug program. Then you have the anger management or the domestic violence. Again, those are needed, but sometimes I see there's just a broad brush approach to mandating guys into programs. Now, as far as hurdles with work, as I mentioned earlier, if guys are not certified, or if their educational or their skill level is not up to par, we work with them to get them where they need to be to find work. But even with the federal law now in place, what employers do to skirt is they will hire you. And once you're hired, they will submit a background check. Now, once they submit a background check, they'll rescind the position. Right? Yeah, they'll rescind the position. But there's a good and bad to it. The new law states that if you are hired and then you're terminated, the employer has to give you documentation stating why you were not hired.
Why they rejected you.
Yes. What individuals can do then is they can appeal the decision. I had a guy that worked seasonal for UPS. Mm-hmm. He worked so well that they kept him on for a lot longer than the seasonal period. And then after a while, he wasn't working and he went to prison for a burglary. When he came out, he went back and applied. He was hired again. They did the background check and then they terminated him. And they stated that they were concerned about their merchandise because of his burglary charge. The federal government has a bonding program. It's called the federal bonding program. And the federal government will bond any formerly incarcerated person for $10,000. We appealed to UPS. We sent them all of the certifications, all of the classes that this gentleman took while he was inside. We found his old supervisor at the old UPS position. He wrote him a letter of recommendation. We sent them the federal government's bonding program information. He was hired. He was rehired. In about 4 months, he was moved up to a supervisory position. And here in New York City, our Department of Employment Services through the Chamber of Commerce, they had a huge gala, and this guy was awarded. He was given an award. Yeah, yeah. So,
that is an incredible story to go from one end to the total end, or to one side to the total opposite side.
Yes.
So you're talking about these programs and you're talking about how the implementation is done in sort of this broad stroke way. Can you go just a little bit onto that? What do you mean? Because I totally know what you mean by in terms of programs that are designed as sort of good faith, we're watching out for the
public
for
safety,
your well-being,
and
for,
safety
exactly
of the public.
For public safety.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, and so they want you to check in and to get back on your feet, but then the requirements of these programs are so invasive that it's almost it makes it harder to find work, because you if you have a 3 hour obligation, 3 hour, three, you know, three times a week that limits your opportunities. You can't have full time work.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Here in New York, you know, our parole and supervised release, their motive or their aim, their goal is to protect the public, but they also are supposed to help, you know, support individuals. You know, we don't see that. We see much more public safety. But yeah, these programs and these mandates they have, and then we haven't even gotten into, you know, interpersonal relationships between individuals and their officers. All right, that's a whole nother dynamic. That's a whole nother power dynamic right there. But yes, and don't get me wrong, these mandated programs, they're needed. But I just feel that they need to be looked into a little bit more because they're just used in a way where it's just like another example is like a lot of guys are getting out of prison and they have this mandate where they're not allowed a driver's license. Right.
What?
They have no. Yeah. They're not allowed. Not that they're not allowed a driver's license. They're not allowed to drive. Right. I've had guys come to me and say, hey, my parole officer told me that I can't drive. You know, and I'm like, do you have a crime with the car? No. Have you ever had a crime with a car? No. Okay. What I would advise you to do is speak with your officer and see if you could have that mandate removed because they have nothing to justify it. You know, so if you have a program, like you said, that you have to go to, if you are restricted to driving, some guys are restricted in the areas in which they can work.
Oh, yeah, right? Exactly. That's difficult because if you're limiting someone's ability to drive, then you're also choking out, you know, like how many different options for employment. I mean, if you live in a neighborhood where it just so happens that the only thing that's nearby are like fast food jobs, then that significantly limits your income potential.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, what we do is my organization, we fight these policies and we push the conversation about changing things, but that on one side, and then on the other side, what we do is we inform individuals on how to get around or how to get through. Cause sometimes you can't get around. Sometimes you just have to go through and, you know, it's all about just understanding that you're going to have some pushback, but you can't give up. Right. And when I talked about guys giving up, these are some of the dynamics that would make you want to give up as well. You know, you're already limited in your job search. Your education might not be the best. Right. You're traumatized because you just came out of a correctional facility and now you have this. It makes a lot of people just say, you know what? The hell with all of this. Right. It's much easier for me to just, you know, go and do X, Y, Z. You know, and then that helps create that recycling door.
Yeah, it's weird that, you know, we have this system that is so quick to push people into the system, but when it comes to actually releasing them and giving back their freedom, giving back their humanity, there's so few resources available that it's almost like, you know, we're letting these people out into a world knowing that we're putting all these roadblocks, knowing that it's almost like we don't want them to succeed, which is so funny because, like, you know, the narrative in America is like when it comes to criminality or you know, being guilty of anything, it's this idea of, okay, well, you've done the time, now you have to work hard and, like, you know, try to be a good citizen. But you know, so many of the systems in place just don't even allow people to even be able to survive, let alone, you know, be a good person, an outstanding citizen or whatever. So it's crazy. And I'm glad that your organization is working to combat all of this.
Thank you.
Cortez, we are just about to head out, but I have just a couple of questions. What are you working on right now and where can people find your work?
Thank you. Right now, we're actually about to launch some more winter products. One thing that we do is we customize a lot of our clothing, right? A lot of people, yeah, if anyone wants to get in contact with me, they can hit me up on Facebook here, on Instagram, where High and Mighty. I also have a High and Mighty Facebook page. And then on the website, highandmighty.com. And they also can hit me at highandmighty@gmail.com. And we do a lot of customizing because, you know, a lot of people, they like our gear to match their sneakers. You know, so we're big into the customization. And then just on our website. And just look out for the new products that we have coming out. We got some real exciting things coming out. I had a meeting a couple of weeks ago with, I don't know, have you ever heard of Sensei Magazine?
Sounds familiar. What are the cover?
It's S-E-N-S-I. Mm-hmm. It's a cannabis magazine. They're based out on the West Coast, but they're trying to come out here on the East Coast. So I met with them. They want us in the magazine. So that might be something that we're going to see in the future.
Awesome.
Hopefully.
Well,
hopefully.
Again, speaking on scale, I mean, hopefully this is an opportunity for everybody to hear more about High Mighty. But honestly, I really appreciate the conversation, Cortez. You gave us a lot of insight, not even just on your personal experiences running the business and your own experiences with cannabis, but also your wisdom and insight in terms of prison reform. Cortez, anything you'd like to say before we head out?
Absolutely. I want to thank you again for opening up your platform to me. I'm definitely going to be sending you some more stuff. I'm going to be sending you some more stuff. No, you're cool, man. Like I told you, when you first started your page, I've been on your page. I go back and forth with some of your fans, but it's all love, you know. Your page is like one of my favorite pages because you talk about, sorry, I got a notification. You talk about some really, really important topics, right? You bring up some really, really important topics. I love the fact that you have this wide smorgasbord of racial dynamics coming in and we're able to talk. And, you know, I just appreciate that. And I appreciate you, again, opening your platform for me. And, you know, I just wish you continued success. And thank you. Just thank you. You know, and,
awesome.
And
well,
keep living high and mighty.
Well, hopefully when you know, and we'll definitely let everyone know what you're working up to.
Absolutely. Thank you again, brother.
All right, Cortez. Take care.
All right. Peace.
All right. Bye.
All right.
Thank you for listening to another installment of Lag Radio. Lag Radio is an independently produced podcast recorded and edited here in my home office, so I appreciate any and all support. Whether you share this podcast with your friends on social media or sign on to become a sponsor, there are plenty of ways that you can help out. Speaking of which, if you're a small business owner or a person of color who wants to promote your platform, business, or brand, contact me and you can become a sponsor of Lag Radio. We'll have you sponsor some of our episodes and you can even join on to be a guest of the show. If you'd like to listen to previous episodes, you can find Lag Radio on anchor.fm/lagradio or you can listen on any major podcasting app like Google, Spotify, or Apple.